The following talk is by Naomi Klein, a Canadian, an award-winning journalist, and author of the widely acclaimed book, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. Viewing the current economic disaster as another shock, she urges progressives to seize this opportunity to move the country in a new direction. In her talk, she responds to rumors that Larry Summers is to be named Treasury Secretary. Whatever happens, her comments stand as a warning against certain economic policies which Summers championed during the presidencies of H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton. After the talk, Klein responds to questions by Matt Rothschild, editor of The Progressive. This event was sponsored by the Madison Institute and was held in Madison, Wisconsin on November 7, 2008. Naomi Klein.
This is my first speech since the election, since Barack Obama was elected president. This is unfamiliar territory for me, this whole not losing thing. And hey, I say not losing because I'm not ready to say winning, okay? The jury is still out on that. But I did want to share with you an anecdote from my election night. I know everybody has an election night story, but I want to tell you something that I saw on election night, which was really amazing. I was in Washington, D.C., and I was very close to the White House. I was, after the election results were announced, I was walking. So it was 11:30 at night, and, you know, holograms and all that, after all that. I was on K Street. Everyone knows what K Street is, right? Bad place. Walked along K Street, down 19th Street, over to H Street. This is really lobbyist alley. You know, these are the real power brokers, you know? You look at people's faces and you're like, I don't know who you are, but you're up to no good, you know? I'm a little judgmental that way. There's a French phrase for this, which is ça se passe sur le visage, which means they wear it in their face, you know? They all look like Karl Rove. It's crazy. Anyway, there's this one club, and I've passed it many times. I don't live in D.C., but I spend a lot of time there because my husband's working there. And it's literally like a private gentleman's club, okay? It's like from another era. There's no sign, but there's always limousines parked outside. It's very gothic. I know the name, but I'm not going to say the name for legal reasons. And, you know, but it's the kind of place where I always, like, sort of peek in, you know, whenever I pass, because it's the kind of place where you can imagine, you know, Supreme Court judges being bribed by tobacco lobbyists, you know, or, like, Central American coups being plotted, you know, over very, very expensive scotch. Anyway, so I was walking past this club, and I saw these two guys outside, two African-American men, both of them wearing uniforms, and they were partying, and they were, like, high-fiving each other, and they were just celebrating. You know, they were celebrating Obama's victory. And I was trying to figure out, at first I thought they were Secret Service, but then I realized one of them was the doorman from this very stuffy, very Republican men's club, and the other was a limo driver from this club. And they were just alone on the street, just sort of high-fiving each other, right? And as I'm walking by, the door to the club opens, and this guy who looks like, you know, he's just a stereotype, a walking stereotype, he's like Daddy Warbucks, left the club, right? And then, of course, the two men, you know, go to their posts, right? One of them opens the door to the club, standing at attention. The other one opens the back door of the limo. And I look at them, and they're, like, sharing a smile, you know? This guy, meanwhile, looks like someone killed his cat. He is so unhappy, okay? He is not having a good night at 11:30, okay, p.m. And, you know, that was what D.C. felt like that night. And it wasn't just these guys. It was the people making the sandwiches for the... It was the cops. It was the construction workers. It was the cab drivers. Almost everybody, African-American, Latino, just saying, this is our city all of a sudden, right? And it's the lobbyists who are skulking around, right? So, like, for once, you know, the people opening the doors are having a way better time than the people for whom those doors always seemed magically open, right? I just looked at this little vignette and I thought, okay, nobody can tell me this is nothing, right? However, let's take a little second look here. And let's remember that the deep divisions of our culture along lines of race and class still, and wealth and privilege, still very, very much exist in Washington, D.C. They're not going away just because the doormen are having a better night than the cigar chompers. Now, so I was on that high. That was Tuesday night. Wednesday, I kind of buzzed through Wednesday, came back to Toronto. And I have to tell you that on Thursday, yesterday, I had a little bit of a letdown. And that letdown, it has a name. Its name is Larry Summers. Now, it's not a done deal, but the word is, you know, the word is that he appears to be the front runner for Treasury Secretary, for the pick for Treasury Secretary. That's the word. Who knows? It could just be a rumor. We know he has been advising the Obama campaign throughout, so has Robert Rubin. But I heard from a couple of sources it's a done deal. I don't know if that's true or not. Obama didn't announce it today. He could have. If it was a done deal, I think he probably would have. But I had this new emotion, you know, this sort of roller coaster from being like, you know, on such a high. And then I was like, what is this thing I feel? I'm really mad, you know? And I thought, and I have to say, I'm not an Obama maniac or anything, but I'm still mad, despite everything I know about the way the world works. And it's like, what is this? It's like a hope hangover or something. I think it's a hope over. And I don't want you guys to feel a hope over. I'm not trying to spread the hope over. But I want us to try to understand how this could even be on the agenda that Larry Summers, the last Treasury Secretary under Clinton, would be the front runner. Seemingly, you know, with very little debate, very little contestation. What contestation there is mostly involves the sexist remarks he made as president of Harvard about the innate inferiority of women in certain scientific fields, right, which he apologized for and so on. And now there's like a debate going on about whether that fact should keep us from having such a great guy as our Treasury Secretary. That's, you know, one of the framings, right? And it's another sort of like, oh, you Hillary supporters, get over it sort of moment, right? But I find it really remarkable because if we think about the turning point in this election, right? The turning point in this election was when the financial crisis that has been very much alive on Main Street hit Wall Street. It was the week that Fannie and Freddie were nationalized, the week that AIG failed, that Lehman Brothers failed. And that was the moment, I think it's really important to remember, that before that, Obama was in trouble. We were scared, okay? He did not get the bump that was expected out of the Democratic convention. And McCain was riding a momentum leading into the RNC and the appointment of Palin. Seemed to be going very, very well. I don't know about you, but I was really, really scared that week. Then the crisis hit, and Obama found a new language. And he found, you know, okay, granted, McCain went nuts and started acting really crazy, right? That happened too. I noticed that as well. The appointment of Palin suddenly looked not such a good idea in the context of a global economic meltdown. That seemed like a little bit of a gimmick all of a sudden. Buyer's remorse. And but I think more importantly, Obama named the moment, and he named the crisis correctly. He diagnosed it correctly as being the result of an ideology, the ideology of rampant deregulation and the idea of, as he said again and again, giving more and more to the people at the top and waiting for it to trickle down. So he really made the election at that point a referendum on laissez-faire economics, on the ideology of deregulation. So how is it possible that after winning an election on those terms, then you end up with Larry Summers? Well, the answer to that is that you have to listen very closely to what Obama said and to what people repeated. He said, the deregulation ideology that has been gripping this country for 8 years. For 8 years, right? I think we've all been suffering from a little collective amnesia. And that was the sort of Faustian bargain of this election. We were all going to pretend, right, that it really was only 8 years. And we were just happy that he was saying the right things, right? The problem with that Faustian bargain is that what created the economic time bomb that exploded on Wall Street was a series of very deliberate acts, and the most important of those acts took place in 1999 and 2000, right? And we have erased that history, okay? We're not interested in that history. The Financial Services Modernization Act, that was signed into law in 1999. That was the law that killed Glass-Steagall, which was the Depression-era piece of legislation that made it illegal, that put up a firewall between investment banks and commercial banks. That if you want to gamble, you gamble with your investors' money, you get into trouble, that's your problem. If you want to be a commercial bank, we will guarantee you, we will offer guarantees for your deposits, but you can't gamble, right? And sure, you know, that was eroded under Reagan, but it was the 1999 law that killed it. And the person who introduced Bill Clinton before he signed in this piece of legislation calling it the right framework for America's future financial system was Larry Summers, okay? So if we are going to willfully forget, then we will end up back where we started, right? 2000, Larry Summers was once again by Bill Clinton's side, signing the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, which is what made sure that this shadow banking industry, the derivatives industry, was out of the reach of regulators. And it's been fun beating up on Alan Greenspan and blaming it all on him. Look, I like seeing Alan Greenspan squirm as much as the next person, you know, fundamental flaw in his logic and all of that. But it was not all about Alan Greenspan. And it wasn't just that the Democrats let them get away with it or got bullied. They had real partners. You know, and you know, in the shock doctrine, I have a couple of quotes from Larry Summers in the context of Russia and the shock therapy experiments in the mid-90s, which he was up to his neck in. I start a chapter with a quote from Larry Summers because he says, he said something that so typified the evangelical zeal with which market fundamentalism was being spread in this period. At this point, he was senior economist at the World Bank. He said, spread the truth. The laws of economics are like the laws of engineering. The same laws work everywhere. Privatization, deregulation. Okay, that was his mantra. He wasn't passive in this. He was an evangelist. We cannot forget this history. I think there was good reason why many of us on the left, many progressives, have been willing to engage in this kind of willful collective amnesia, or at least pretend we don't hear the over the past 8 years part and pretend that we're hearing since Reagan, right? Because I think that we have been living through a period where we've had a common enemy and some fantastic coalitions, some very strong coalitions have been built between leftists, liberals, progressives, people who don't maybe usually get along that well, but who all could agree that the number one thing that needed to happen was getting rid of the Republicans. But any act of intellectual dishonesty takes its toll. This has been the fairy tale that I think a lot of us have been accepting on the progressive side. The idea that, yes, it's all about deregulation, it's all about privatization, this idea that the market can fix everything, but we don't want to talk about the Clinton years. You know, we don't want to talk about what a bipartisan project this was. We don't want to talk about the corporate ownership of the two-party system, right? So we've made that calculation. And in regaining some of that intellectual honesty in order to meet the moment that we're in, it is going to mean that some of those coalitions aren't going to hold together, right? Because some people are going to say, we don't want to hear it if you're criticizing Obama. And we have to accept that there's going to be some consequences for this. But there's if that's our fairy tale, if that's been our fairy tale, we know the bigger fairy tale about how we ended up with this Wild West system of deregulated markets that has imploded so spectacularly. And that's the fairy tale that this all started with Reagan and Thatcher, that free markets and free people go hand in hand, that this ideology has spread throughout the world, China, Russia, Latin America, because this is the best way to run a society and because people demanded it. This is the Francis Fukuyama thesis, the end of history. He described this as the end point of mankind's ideological evolution, right, in 1989. And we've heard a very triumphant version of history now, until this moment where we're actually hearing a critical version, but a short-sighted version. We had been living with this triumphant version, that free markets and free people go hand in hand, that the spreading of this ideology is synonymous with freedom itself. And the reason why we have been living with a fairy tale is because the history has been told by the think tanks. The history has been told by the Crusaders, by the Heritage Foundation, by the American Enterprise Institute, by the editorial pages of the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post. They're telling their own triumphant history. So, of course, they want to equate this this ideology with freedom and liberation itself. Now, for those of you who've read the book, and I'm, you know, because I am getting so much into the elections, and I want to make sure that we have time for discussion. You know, I'm not going to try to summarize the whole thesis of the shock doctrine here, get into it in too much detail. You know, but what the book really is an alternative history of how we ended up with market fundamentalism around the world. This isn't just an American phenomenon. It isn't just about American-style capitalism. We have been living a revolt of the elites, a liberation movement of capital. It is the most successful liberation movement of our time. And it is the movement by the most powerful and wealthiest forces in the world, not just in this country, but in Latin America, in Russia, in China, to liberate themselves from all constraints on their ability to accumulate massive profits. And the legacy of inequality that has opened up during these key three decades tells the story of the success of this counter-revolution. It has been a success. If we think about it as a class war waged by the wealthy against everyone else, then it isn't an implosion. It isn't a disaster. It is a success. The way I tell the story in the book is that we need to look at this in the context of the last great financial disaster of the Great Depression, and the fact that after that market crash, after 1929, and in the midst of the Great Depression, the left was mobilized, the left was organized, and the left diagnosed what had happened on Wall Street as a failure of laissez-faire economics. And more than that, they had the confidence to assert an alternative vision in that moment of crisis. They discredited the elites, and they put forward another vision of the world. And it was that vision that won Social Security, that won public housing in places like New Orleans. And what we have been living since Reagan in this country is the counter-revolution against those gains, against those gains. Now, the reason why crisis and shock has been so important is because these are not popular ideas. There are pieces of the agenda that are popular, like tax cuts. Everyone loves a tax cut, okay? But people will protect their labor standards. People will protect their Social Security once they have it. In Canada, you know, where I live, you know, we got our national health care system after the Second World War where a man named Tommy Douglas, who was a leader of the New Democratic Party, our third party, who had polio as a child and almost had to have his leg amputated, but for an act of charity, that somebody paid for his private health care. He said, in a country that could spend so much on the war, we should be able to get health care to every person in this country. And that's why these moments of crisis are so volatile and so, in fact, dangerous to the elites, because when we see the state able to do things like wage wars, like Save Wall Street so enthusiastically, it does occur to us that maybe everything that they've been saying about all the things they can't do, the decent things that they can't do, is the big lie. So, you know, this counter-revolution had a problem, you know, and that my point in Canada is that to this day, every single political party in every single election has to run on a platform promising to protect health care. Doesn't matter how right-wing the party is. You will lose the election unless you promise to protect health care and public broadcasting. Because once you have the institutions, people will protect them. People will protect them. They love them, right? I mean, the only thing you can really hope to do is erode them and cut them and cut them and cut them until, you know, they're so destroyed and so ugly that nobody wants to protect them anymore, right? That's another strategy. But the point is that people do protect these institutions that do spread the wealth, to use an unpopular phrase, whether it's public education or health care, or even public funding for the arts or media, God forbid. So there needs to be a strategy to unmake these gains. There has to be a strategy to unmake these gains. Look at Bush. You know, he wanted to privatize Social Security. He went on a listening tour across the country, and people told him to shut up, right? They said, we want to protect public health care. We want to protect Social Security. And I was very interested that the same day that Henry Paulson announced the largest budget deficit in U.S. history a couple of weeks ago, thanks to his own actions, he also said, and this means that we're going to have to re-examine some of our entitlement reform programs, right? Now, when he's talking about entitlement, he doesn't mean all those bankers who feel entitled to tens of billions of dollars of public money, no strings attached. He's talking about elderly people who feel entitled to some small pension in their old age or to some health care coverage. So they're using this crisis, and this is the point, that these policies need a crisis in order to advance. And I start the book with a quote that I've used many times, and many of you have heard me say it many times, from Milton Friedman in 1982, when this country was in an economic crisis. He said, "Only a crisis, actual or perceived, produces real change. And when that crisis occurs, the change depends on the ideas that are lying around." Now, he understood that his ideas were actually not compatible with an electoral democracy. He learned it the hard way. He thought that when Richard Nixon was elected, he said that he couldn't imagine an American president more ideologically in line with his own ideas. He was delighted, and his good friend Donald Rumsfeld, who he had mentored, even got a very important budget position in the Nixon administration. So did George Shultz, his old friend from the University of Chicago. But then an economic crisis hit, and the ideas that were lying around were Keynesian ideas. And the people wanted government action, and they still hadn't been conditioned to think that the government couldn't do anything to help. So Nixon imposed wage and price controls, and it was so damn popular that he got reelected, right? And there's this funny anecdote that Donald Rumsfeld told at Milton Friedman's 90th birthday party. They threw a party for him on Capitol Hill. George Bush threw this party to celebrate Milton Friedman. Donald Rumsfeld made a speech. He said, "Milton Friedman is the embodiment of the notion that ideas have consequences." I couldn't agree more, by the way. And he told this story about how when he was a young man working in the budget office, he was in charge of those wage and price controls. And Milton Friedman called him up irate. He said, "Look, what are you doing? You know, imposing wage and price controls, this is the most Keynesian thing you could possibly do." And Rumsfeld said, "Well, people seem to like it." And Friedman said, "Well, that's just the point. That's the worst part. They're learning the wrong lesson." So this was a really disillusioning experience for Friedman, who, after all, had written a book called Capitalism and Freedom, trying to equate the ideas of capitalism and freedom. And here you have this democracy problem of people actually wanting intervention, voting for politicians who do it, Nixon declaring we're all Keynesians now, the ultimate betrayal. And in a snip, in a temper tantrum, Friedman wrote that declared Nixon the most socialist president in modern history. So it's not just Barack Obama, by the way. He has company. So this idea that you need a crisis, it, you know, it's not about the way progressives responded to the Great Depression, which was a broadening of the political space, which was bringing more people into the political process and grassroots organizing. This is a strategy of democracy avoidance, right? It's that when there is a crisis, Then you can do exactly what Paulson is trying to do with Social Security. Sure, we couldn't sell privatization of Social Security without a crisis. But now that we can say we have no choice, it's a state of emergency, well, we need an emergency economic team, special powers. So even within an electoral democracy, you can gain a huge amount of power within an economic crisis. And we saw the ultimate attempt of this with Paulson's original plan, that unbelievable three-page document that many of us read, which was basically like a stick-up of epic proportions, right? The $700 billion stick-up. Give me $700 billion. No oversight. No court of law. No arm of any government can ever review these decisions. I always feel that the biggest mistake that the Bush administration made with that bailout plan was how short that document was. Because people started comparing it to the Patriot Act, right? They were calling it an economic Patriot Act. But the thing about the Patriot Act is it was so long that people didn't actually read it until it was already law. They were like, oh no, what have we done, right? That's usually the way crisis works, is that there is a crisis, there is a state of panic. We want to trust that Rudy Giuliani or Dick Cheney or Henry Paulson, despite our better judgment, are really going to take care of us this time, right? They really have our best interests at heart. And very sweeping pieces of legislation get pushed through, but usually the documents are really long. The thing about the Paulson plan is that it was just 3 pages long, right? So this crazy thing happened, which is that people read it. Everyone read this thing. They blogged about it. They linked to it, right? Everyone read it but John McCain. He was the only person in the country who read this document. And they didn't like it. And, you know, something pretty amazing happened is that, well, first of all, there was an election going on. And politicians found themselves unusually interested in the views of their constituents. You remember that day when Chris Dodds came into work and was like, 99% of the calls I'm getting are against this bailout. And it was that period, well, first of all, that Congress, in that surprise vote, voted against the first version of the bailout. New York Times did an analysis and found that the Congress people who voted against the bailout were overwhelmingly Congress people in very tight races, i.e. they were fighting for their jobs, and they were the ones who really had to listen to what the voters thought. And then they revised it, and then they added a whole bunch of tax breaks to it, and they managed to ram the thing through. And I'm going to come back to that, come back to the state of the bailout a little bit later on. But we are living examples of the shock doctrine right now. We're seeing how economic crisis is an opportunity, and it doesn't always work. This is why it's important to talk about it. You know, if I thought that this was just a closed system and that it was all inevitable, I wouldn't have bothered writing a book about it, right? I wouldn't bother speaking about it. The reason why I speak about it is because these are tactics. This shock doctrine strategy that Milton Friedman articulated in 1982 and that I show how it was implemented in Latin America during the debt crisis, in Russia during the transition and after the collapse of the Soviet Union, in Poland in 1989, these moments of very rapid political change when everybody is focused on big P politics and not on economics, like South Africa in 1992, 93, 94, in the transition from apartheid to democracy. This is when so much is lost. But the way it's lost is that we don't realize it's happening. Right? This is a strategy that really doesn't work if we know about it. Right? It shrivels up as soon as a little bit of light is shown on it. And that's why I think there is a sort of law of diminishing return for all of these shock tactics. And that's really why the bailout, there was so much resistance to the bailout, is because it reminded us of something, right? You know, even though in this very amnesiac culture, you know, what Gore Vidal calls the United States of amnesia, we remembered something. We remembered that they had done this after 9/11. And we, you know, John Stewart did that fantastic public service of cutting together Bush's WMD speech, right, with his bailout speech. It was like the same speech. So, you know, we were engaging in this process of pattern recognition. And the more we understand these tactics, the less they work on us, okay? I have a little bit more time. If you don't mind, I'm just going to talk a tiny bit about Russia, which is, you know, the book, like I said, you know, it's a long book, and it's an alternative history So I usually talk about Latin America and talk about Iraq. And, you know, Iraq is really the classic example of, and it's why I wrote the book, because I was in Baghdad. During Paul Bremer's time there, you had the shock and awe invasion, and then you had economic shock therapy, an attempt to radically remake Iraq's economy, and the window of opportunity opened up by that wrenching crisis. And when that didn't work, people were rounded up and their bodies were shocked in places like Abu Ghraib. So you had three different kinds of shock, and that's when I really got interested in this idea. Now, the book, you know, gets into some lesser-known chapters of this history. And I do want to talk about Russia just because it relates to the summer situation, as it were. And because it isn't just that what Larry Summers did in this country. It's what Larry Summers did as Undersecretary of the Treasury, and also as Treasury Secretary, and also as a chief economist at the World Bank. And the place where he had his most influence was Russia. He was involved in Russia policy at the World Bank, and then he was put in charge of the Russia portfolio when he moved over to Treasury in 1993. And what happened in Russia in this period really shows the lack of commitment to democracy and actually the clash between real democracy, real self-determination, which includes the right to decide what kind of economy you want, and this free market fundamentalist crusade being waged by people like Summers, who are proudly saying there is one set of laws that works everywhere in the world. So you know, what happened in this period is that there was a tremendous shock to the country. There was the economic crisis, but the real shock was the dissolution, the very sudden dissolution of the Soviet Union. People didn't know what country they were living in. They were in the midst of an economic crisis. Things were moving very, very quickly. Workers weren't being paid. It was just absolute chaos. And the country needed help. Now, Gorbachev had a vision of gradual reform. He thought it would take about 10 years and that the end goal would be to try to have something like the Scandinavian social democratic model. That was his vision. We'll never know whether he could have pulled it off because he was sidelined and Boris Yeltsin came to power and he had a group of economists around him who were known as the Chicago Boys. Now, they were known as the Chicago Boys because they modeled themselves after the group of Chilean economists who surrounded Augusto Pinochet. That was their model, and they would often talk about the Pinochet option. Now, what Gorbachev tried to do, his vision was to democratize the political structures and then introduce the economic reforms gradually. So they had elections, they had constitution. This was perestroika, glasnost, the opening up. And then the economic reforms started gradually. He went to the G8 summit in 1991. He made his argument that it would take 10 years. He was told that he had to go the quote-unquote shock therapy route. He was told this by Bush Sr., who was president at the time. And they said that they had to do something very, very quickly, something on like a six-month model. This was tied to international aid because, of course, Russia was desperate. They needed a loan from the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, and the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, with people like Larry Summers there, said made it conditional on economic shock therapy, very rapid privatizations, very rapid deregulation, the big bang approach. Okay. Now, Yeltsin was given a lot of power, and the Chicago Boys were given a lot of power to try to make this work. They were given 2 years, but it didn't work, and the country was spiraling into crisis. And the Russian parliament, which was elected, not a perfect body by any means, but it was a nascent democracy in a country in transition. They said that they'd had enough, the people were angry. They didn't support shock therapy, and they called an end, the Russian parliament called an end to the economic experiment, okay? And they said that all the economic measures now had to go through parliament, which is a normal way that a democracy works. Well, Larry Summers, who is now at Treasury, was having none of it. This is what he said. He at the time, he was Treasury Undersecretary. He warned that the momentum for Russian reform must be reinvigorated and intensified to ensure sustained multilateral support, right? Which means democracy be damned. If you're going to have sustained multilateral support, i.e. any aid at all, you have to continue down this route that your parliament has just voted against, okay? So now that Yeltsin has this clear message from Washington, what does he do? He suspends the Constitution. He dissolves Parliament. He basically stages a coup. He calls in the tanks. This is what they called the Pinochet option. Okay? They called in the tanks on the Russian Parliament, which is known as the White House. The building was so charred by the attack that it became known temporarily as the Black House because it was charred black. Between 100 and 500 demonstrators were killed in the clashes outside Parliament. It was very bloody. And that night, the night of the real coup, a World Bank economist said that now there was nothing to stop them from pushing through their reforms. And he said, and I quote him in the book, "I've never had so much fun in my life." Okay? So what Larry Summers said at the time was that now they have to move as fast as possible on all front on the three, what he called Asians, the three Asians, privatization, stabilization, liberalization. Okay? It was in this period immediately after that you had the commanding heights of Russia's economy handed over very, very quickly to a small group of business people who became known as the Russian oligarchs. Okay? But it's important to understand that there was a collision between democratic reform and the agenda of free market fundamentalism. And when it came down to choosing, democracy lost, right? So now it's very easy. You know, everyone loves bashing Putin, and why not, right? He's taken Russia back into an era of authoritarianism, but it didn't start with him. It started when American advisors and people like Larry Summers in Washington directed the Russian government to sacrifice democracy in the name of their ideology. So this is what he has on his hands, and it's a lot more than a sexist remark. 60 million Russians were pushed into poverty in this period. A lot of them were women, by the way. Women always lose the most in these periods. All right. So the question that we have before us is whether we can somehow use the leverage of this incredible thing that happened, which is that an election was won that was campaigned as a referendum on these very policies. And more than that, the process that brought Obama to power was really unique. It was really unlike anything we've seen before in terms of how much grassroots energy there was, how much youth energy there was, the fact that he tapped into something so real and tangible that it was almost impossible to resist, which was that very real hope and dream of a different kind of country. He did do that. So the question is, what can we do with this moment? And, you know, shock really is a war on memory, this state of shock that we go into in these moments of crisis. It's not just that something bad is happening to us. We go into shock when something bad happens that we don't understand, right? That's what a shock is. It's a gap between an event and a story that we have to explain that event. And that's why people were resistant originally during the bailout, is that we did have a story. We had some points of references. We said, this is like this. This is like that. This is not all new, right? We are not being completely reborn in this moment of crisis. We had some markers, something to hold on to. Now, you know, that is a very small example, because remembering something that happened 7 years ago or something that happened 5 years ago, that's not the kind of deep historical memory that is going to carry us through a moment of crisis like this. But, you know, I always remember that after September 11th, the Bush administration really, really waged a war on memory. Because if we think about that, you know, that really was the quintessential collective shock. If we think about what people were saying in that moment, you know, who are these people? Why do they hate us? Right? It was the event itself. But more than that, it was the fact that there was no narrative to explain the event. It was that the attack seemed not to come from this world. It seemed to come from another planet. We were people without a narrative, right? And it was in that moment when suddenly people were rushing out and buying history books and reading about the CIA funding for the Mujahideen and, you know, building in that gap. Because history is what orients us. It tells us where we are in time and space, and that's how you stay out of shock. That's how you stay out of a state of shock. And what I always think is so striking about that moment was that the Bush administration's response to that very healthy impulse of people to fill in the gap in the narrative and collectively come to a new narrative, learn that history, fill in the gaps, was to say that the act of trying to understand where these attacks come from is to sympathize with the terrorists, right? Is to rationalize the acts, is to essentially be a terrorist yourself because you're either with us or you're against us, right? And so on the one hand, it was don't look back, right? Don't you dare look back. But also, we have some brand new narratives for you, people, because we can't survive without stories. We need them. And it was the clash of civilizations, and it was the axis of evil, and it was the endless war on terror. So we had our new stories, and we clung to them for dear life. Or we lost confidence. Those of us who didn't buy the news stories, maybe we lost confidence in the stories that we did know. Like, wait a minute, did Bush really invent free trade and deregulation and privatization? Didn't Clinton have a little something to do with that? Weren't some of us part of a movement in the streets of Seattle and Washington and Genoa fighting this very ideology in the 90s? So we need to get oriented. And I think, you know, what I feel optimistic about is that the progressive history in this country, you know, it tells us where we need to be going. And I'm, you know, it's been amazing to see the history of the New Deal, which has been such a sort of, you know, profanity since Reagan. You know, you weren't even allowed to talk about it. Suddenly everyone's talking about a green New Deal and green collar jobs. And, you know, something really is changing. And it really is worth remembering that this whole infrastructure that the right has built to have their ideas lying around when the next crisis hits, and to have all of those right-wing think tanks, you know, I call them the people paid to think by the makers of tanks, you know, I don't think we should be so dispirited by it. I think the reason why they need that infrastructure is because actually the organic responses to moments of crisis are actually much more progressive. It's a much more natural response to look at a crisis like what we're seeing on Wall Street and say, actually, we need rules and we need a better system than this, than to do what the think tanks are saying, which is actually we need fewer rules and we need to drill, baby, drill, and, you know, in the context of climate change. I mean, their messages are totally counterintuitive to what we're seeing around us. So I feel like what we lack, even more than the ideas, is the confidence in those ideas. You know, the confidence to fight for those ideas when it really matters, when we really have an opening, when we have a crisis that makes our arguments for us. And, you know, we know from our personal lives, from our family lives, and from our collective lives, that when a crisis hits, we do face a choice. We can trust in authority, or we can find new reserves of strength in ourselves. We can regress, or we can grow up. And it's time to grow up. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, several questions by Matt Rothschild, editor of The Progressive, followed by responses by Naomi Klein.
Well, I have plenty to ask Naomi, but I just wanted to say at the beginning, first of all, thank you to Naomi Klein for that incredible presentation and how honored we are to have her here in Madison. My questions really are to ask you to elaborate on a couple things. One, in your book, you talk about the waning power of the IMF and the World Bank and whether you still think that's true or whether in this period of crisis they are going to reassert their power. And by they reasserting their power, I think we should be clear that means essentially the U.S. government and the Treasury Department of the United States, which has dominated the IMF and the World Bank from inception, both economically and in decision-making powers. Another big question is Iraq. You've been there. What's your observation of where we are now? How do we get out of there? Will Obama get us out of there? And the third other category is more amplification on the bailout, the shortcomings of the bailout, the dirty little details that you've discovered by looking at the actual documents of the bailout. So that's enough for now, I think.
Thank you, Matt. It's an honor to be sharing the stage with you, and I'm a big fan of The Progressive, and how wonderful to have that fantastic magazine in your community. Okay. Waning power of the IMF and the World Bank. It's one of the more worrying things about this moment, because it is true that, the argument I make in the book is that the reason why we're seeing the intensity of the shocks increase before you have these the economic policies introduced, like a war in Iraq followed by economic shock therapy, or, you know, the Asian tsunami being exploited to push through privatization policies in Asia, is because the more peaceful methods of imposing the so-called Washington consensus really were not working anymore. The World Trade Organization talks have pretty much been derailed since Seattle. They got on track a little bit in Doha, really at the barrel of a gun, with Zelik over there saying, if you don't, sign this agreement, then you don't love America, right after 9/11, right? But the talks have never really been back on track since Seattle. And then you had the International Monetary Fund, being forced to sell its gold, and having a financial crisis of its own, laying off staff, just a few months ago, because so many countries were becoming either self-sufficient, or you had countries like Venezuela becoming lenders of last resort in Latin America and China. And this had to do with the high commodity prices. So, the crisis, there's really a triple crisis going on in the developing world. You have the financial crisis. You have the food crisis, which is a much more immediate crisis. The price of food has skyrocketed, and the need for aid is tremendous. And then you have the fact that now the price of oil is dropping. So countries like Venezuela are less able to play that role of lender of last resort. So in fact, what's happening is the IMF is back with big time just in the past couple of weeks. And they are attaching conditions to the loans. I mean, one thing you have to always watch with the, Bretton Woods institutions is that they're masters of reinvention, right? I mean, they learned a decade ago that they weren't allowed to say structural adjustment, and then they learned that they weren't allowed to say privatization. So they said public-private partnerships, there's always a new language. But the players are very much the same. Yeah, I think the real pity is that the reason why we have the Bretton Woods institutions, the spirit in which they were created, in large part it was the vision of Keynes after he had been vindicated, tragically so, because he had warned after the Treaty of Versailles that you can't allow a country to spiral into depression. And he wrote in Economic Consequences of the Peace, he predicted that the punitive sanctions that had been imposed on Germany after World War I would come back to haunt the rest of the world. And he said, vengeance will not limp. And that economic shock was compounded by the Great Depression. And sure enough, you had the fertile ground for fascism. And no one listened to Keynes, in the 20s, but they were ready to listen to him. They were ready to listen to him after the Second World War. And that was the idea of the Bretton Woods institutions of the World Bank and the IMF, was that they would prevent these types of shocks, that they would be stabilizing forces. And in fact, what we have is these institutions that have allowed crises to deepen so that they can be leveraged to push through structural adjustment programs, particularly in Larry Summers' day, particularly during the Asian economic crisis, which was really, I think, the worst moment for the multilateral agencies, and was the moment, certainly in Asia, where just governments swore them off. So I'm hearing murmurs of a new movement to try to counter this idea that it can only be the rich countries who come up with the solutions to this financial crisis that actually affect the poorest countries the most, that it has to be a genuinely democratic process, and that it has to be a genuinely decentralized process. Now, I don't think that these institutions are reformable. I really don't. I think the idea of all roads leading through Washington, that era is over, and that there needs to be, it needs to be a multipolar world. One of the things that I've been talking about what progressives need to understand about Obama, and this comes maybe back to the Iraq question a little bit, is that I don't feel betrayed by Obama, in truth, because I think Obama is a centrist, and I think he's been very honest about that, and that is who he is. Everything about him is that. And I think that the role of progressives when faced with a centrist is to move the center, right? And those are the conditions under which the New Deal was achieved in this country. It wasn't that FDR just handed it down from on high. You know, we have a very anemic version of history that we tell the great man's story. But the truth was he was under enormous pressure from below, and that enabled him to sell the New Deal as a compromise. But I was saying this, that we need to move the center, and I was corrected by a Latin American scholar who said that actually what we need are many centers. And I think that's a great image to think about how we emerge from this crisis, is it isn't just about making the Washington institution better or the Geneva institutions better. We have to, as Arundhati Roy says, we have to close the gap, close the distance between where decisions are made and where the effects of those decisions are felt. And that means a regionalization, a decentralization of power, which is entirely compatible with coordination, with internationalism, with international responses. But the idea of just coming up with a better one-size-fits-all model that will fit everywhere, spread the word, as Larry Summers said, I don't think that that's the model that we should be looking for. Now, in terms of whether, Iraq, obviously, no. This is another example of this. Will Obama get us out? Well, no, but he didn't say he would. And this is our own selective listening and our own self-delusion if we're waiting for that. He has not run as an anti-war candidate, okay? He ran on a platform to keep the green zone intact, okay? And the green zone is the symbol of the U.S. occupation in Iraq. It is the most inflammatory part of the U.S. presence in Baghdad. It is an annexation of the most significant parts of the downtown core, right? It's like saying, okay, we're not occupying America, but we like the White House, Treasury, some of those nice parks and monuments you've got. We're just going to take that, right? I mean, that is the green zone. It's a city within a city in Baghdad. And that's why it has to be so fortified. And that's why Obama will not say that he will pull out Blackwater, because he understands that he can't sustain his plan without the mercenaries, right? And my friend Jeremy Scahill has asked him this directly. So I think we should take him at his word. I think we should take him at his word. And we need to rebuild the independent anti-war movement. And it has to happen, but it will not happen without that massive pressure from below. I think there's something, I suppose, a little bit sad about having to say this in this moment when we feel so much hope. But I really want to resist this temptation to frame it as a betrayal by Obama. Honestly, it's not. He's been honest. We've betrayed ourselves. We've made some calculations, and we have to live with those calculations, and we have to get up, and we have to organize again. Just like always, no shortcuts. In terms of the bailout, I've written quite a lot about the bailout lately, and the stakes of it are enormously high. I think that what this moment is really about for us is not about bashing Obama. It is about trying to make a turn from a movement that resisted a third Republican term, and everybody helped with that, right? Whether or not they were in the Obama camp or not, in the critiques, in the organizing, and whether we can make a turn into being an independent social movement that puts pressure on Obama to keep the progressive promises that he made, but also push him to be more progressive. His big green energy program, $150 billion that he's promising for green alternative energy. Okay, first of all, a lot of that is nuclear and coal. All right. So what's our job? Get the nuclear and coal out, because that isn't green or sustainable. Okay? And much more wind and solar. That's already under pressure from the right, who are saying, we've got an economic crisis on our hands. We have to re-examine entitlement programs, i.e., they want to erode the meager services that
the United States government currently offers in exchange for taxation, okay? Because, by the way, you guys really don't get much. Compared to other countries and compared to the taxes you pay, you get very little. That is under siege, let alone these new ideas, these new plans on the agenda. So I think that this is really what's at stake in the bailout, because the worse the bailout deal is, you know, the more it is just a transfer of public money into private hands. The more you have, you know, a bomb waiting to explode on the public books that will be used to say this is why we can't afford that Green New Deal. Now, I said $150 billion for alternative energies. But, you know, AIG got $143 billion, okay? You know, with the amount of money just AIG got, you could have health care for every child in this country, right? So it matters that the bailout is terrible. And I think that the first test of the idea of whether we can make this turn from a pro-Obama movement, for lack of a better, you know, phrase, into an independent counter-pressure that both pressures Obama and reminds the Republicans that they lost, okay? And make this about democracy. You know, I think the first test is whether we can get a better deal on the bailout, because everything's at stake here. You know, there's a real knock-on effect. This bad deal will be used to say you can't have a Green Deal. And the hopes of that better future are being sacrificed, you know, for these Wall Street banks. And I mean, the bottom line is that we were sold, and this is where Obama has room to move. Obama voted for the bailout, but the bailout was sold on false pretenses. So he has an exit clause, and we should be pressuring him to use it, okay? It was very unpopular for him to vote for the bailout. But the way it was sold was that they were going to inject liquidity into the banks, and the banks were going to lend. Okay. Now, the banks have taken the money, and they've said, thanks very much, we're going to give it as bonuses to shareholders, and we're going to maybe buy a few other banks. Okay. Now, even the New York Times is saying, they wrote an editorial saying that all the bailout funds should be frozen, and they shouldn't hand anything out until they can renegotiate these deals. The deals themselves... So what we should be doing is encouraging Obama to use this loophole. Okay. You know, he voted for it. That's a done deal. But there is an out clause, which is that this is not the deal that was sold to us. So that's an opportunity. And I think it should be our first big task. I think that this deal needs to be completely renegotiated. And in terms of, you know, there has already been one victory, which was the original Paulson plan, is now pretty much dead. And that original Paulson plan was just to take the toxic debts and move them from Wall Street to Washington. That was a terrible idea. It's been completely discredited, and it looks like they're not really even going to be doing it. Then they said, we're going to do part of it, and now they haven't even done any of it yet, and I think it's really possible to just kill it completely. Then the question is, what are the terms of these equity injections? And what's amazing is that, you know, Paulson sat down with the 9 big banks, and then the narrative in the press was Paulson was really tough, and he twisted their arms to take the money. I mean, how stupid do they think we are, right? Really stupid, okay? I mean, I was looking at this, you know, the banks came in at 3 p.m. on a Monday, and they left at 4. All of them signed, okay? You don't get 9 banks, the biggest banks in the United States, to all sign on the dotted line unless you have given them a deal so sweet that their lawyers could never have written anything better. And what was incredible was that 5 days earlier, Gordon Brown had set the benchmark. He had partially nationalized several British banks, and he set the terms. He showed how it was done. He gave the template. Okay, voting in exchange for this cash infusion, you get equity, but you also get voting rights. You get seats on the board and 12% annual return. Okay, on investment. So 5 days later, what does tough guy Henry Paulson come back with? 5%. Okay, no voting rights. No seats on the board. Oh, and the other thing, Gordon Brown got it in writing that they had to spend the money on loans for small businesses and homeowners. Paulson just thought they'd go with the honor system. Okay? So, I mean, this is a terrible deal, and it should be renegotiated. And we have the ammo to get it renegotiated. And this, I think, should be our first test. And I don't think it has to be done in a confrontational way. I think we need to just give Obama the ammunition to say, use this loophole.
The foregoing program featured Naomi Klein, author of The Shock Doctrine. Audio recordings of this and many thought-provoking programs of the Madison Institute Forum are available at our website. Go to www.themadisoninstitute.org. The views expressed here are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the sponsors.